Sounding Board, the monthly podcast from new and classic music discussions since 2016. Follow the team on Twitter and Facebook at Sounding Board 69.
Hello and welcome to episode 34 of Sounding Board. Today we welcome back Neil Kennedy. Hi Neil.
Hi Rob.
Good to have you back. Today it's just the two of us and we're going to be talking about nostalgia in music as a broad topic, and hopefully we won't go on for hours, so stick with us. But first of all, you had something to say about the new Freddie Mercury film, or Queen film, should I say?
Yeah.
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that, you know, I suppose it plays into this kind of like general discussion around nostalgia. But I think it's a film that it appears to have had quite a sort of troubled gestation, a different actor taking over as Freddie Mercury in the role. I think Sacha Baron Cohen, who was originally taken on to play Freddie Mercury, had some issues about the things that they were and weren't exploring his life. And by all accounts, the film does swerve to some extent his personal life, which the writers and director have got every right to do if that's not the story they want to tell. But you wonder the extent to which that does give a rounded kind of appreciation of where the guy was coming from as a musician, as an artist. I think it's interesting, we were sort of chatting off mic about the way in which that band is viewed today. There certainly was a lot of people who really didn't like them. I can remember when I was growing up, you know, a lot of people finding them kind of pompous and bombastic and, you know, sort of thinking that they're the band that got through the kind of punk net, so to speak. And obviously there was a kind of political aspect, you know, to some of that. I know you may have mentioned once or twice about their playing at the Sun Stadium, wasn't it, during apartheid in South Africa?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, you know, has been a sort of black mark against them. But I think, you know, it's interesting that there seems to be a nostalgia for these kind of big stadium bands as well, and these big kind of communal musical moments. And obviously with Queen, it's Live Aid at Wembley, and that was where they actually had last night from when we were recording. Premiere of the film was in Wembley Stadium, although it's probably slightly different Wembley Stadium now to where they played on the big screen with sort of 5,000 people watching it. So I thought that was quite interesting in terms of showcasing a musical film. It puts it on in a kind of place that most kind of like musical films and biopics wouldn't normally get.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've seen the trailer, and much as I am not a fan of Queen, and of course I have mentioned that South Africa thing not a few times, I would say it looked as if it was carried off in the trailer with some level of brio, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the casting did look quite interesting. Yeah. It looked quite lively. I can only imagine them now as a sort of massive behind the curtain stadium act, and so to see the early days of them growing up at some Wimbledon or somewhere like South West London is like very interesting to see them just playing small clubs and things, which is just something that seems now with retrospect completely inappropriate for the music, but that was an interesting angle to it. And I mean, it looks like they do mention Freddie Mercury's decline, but I mean, it sounds like they maybe don't go into enough detail about
his personal life. And I think there's very much that his personal life, which was to some extent kept under wraps from the public, and the public weren't aware of, you know, who he really was as an individual outside of the persona that you saw on stage. And, you know, it's possible at the time there might have been some backlash. There certainly would have been some backlash against that to some extent. So I don't know the extent to which the film is exploring that. It doesn't seem like it explores it in any kind of great sense. But as I said, you know, that's kind of their prerogative as filmmakers.
If anybody thinks they're going to get me to go and see it, given the soundtrack, they've got another thing coming. Just from my point of view, I just want to quickly mention the Ritual Union Festival, which was in Oxford. I know a lot of people on the Oxford music scene listen to the podcast, so I thought I would mention it quickly. On Saturday, very well organised again by Future Perfect. I thought actually there was a sort of larger attendance than there was last year. Most of the venues I went to were well attended, so I think it looks like it would have had a good chance of making a good bit of money. And some great performances. I think Nod, who finished fourth in our Album of the Year for 2017.
Did they mention that when they were on stage?
Well, they were very pleased when they came up to thank people afterwards. But they, despite not having a drummer or a guitarist on stage, were quite incendiary, actually. I mean, really, really kind of hard and very, very intense. It was quite strange being in that room while they were playing. Mm. And I thought the other real highlight was Nadine Shah, who sort of narrowly missed out on the Mercury Prize, but just produced a really charismatic performance as it, with her band, and quite different from a lot of the other music that was on that day. So generally, a big thumbs up for Ritual Union.
Sounds great.
Yeah. After this break, we're going to be plunging into the world of nostalgia. Hello again, everyone. As promised at the top of the show, Neil and I are going to talk about nostalgia today in music, and generally I think it's very hard to look at nostalgia without some reference to the political backdrop at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree. I think, you know, certainly in the UK context with Brexit, there has been discussion, rightly or wrongly, around generational divides as they pertain to that particular vote. I suppose more kind of sociologically speaking, you know, you can go around the country and see lots of kind of 1940s themed days, which, you know, in some cases have run the risk of sort of being hagiographic towards periods where things weren't maybe so rosy as they were perhaps, you know, are being portrayed to some extent. Now, I could openly be accused of joining too many dots, but the reason that this kind of as a thing came to mind for me was certainly on this podcast, and we've got kind of long-term kind of form with being fans of labels like Ghostbox, who are quite not, I mean, I wouldn't say they're sort of willingly nostalgic, but they're certainly kind of rooting their music in a particular sort of cultural context and time period is informing them. And I saw a quite interesting review, just a sort of short review on the Norman Records website, a great records online record store if you ever, you know, looking for vinyl. It was a review of, I think, what was at the time the latest release from the Bellbury Circle, which is Bellbury Poly and the Advisory Circle collaborating, and they'd sort of they'd moved beyond 70s, I think, sort of soundscape stuff, more into a more kind of 80s informed sound in the instrumentation they were using. But there was just a sort of hint in that review of slightly mischievously saying, oh, you know, it was all better in the 70s when you could, you know, put Tiz Wars on the telly and sort of you knew what time the milkman was coming and all this kind of stuff. And it did, for me, just ever so slightly sort of make me take a step back and reassess my love of that label to some degree, because I did think about the extent to which I should be really enjoying music that is in the kind of nostalgic political context that's also pitching towards nostalgia as well. I know, you know, fundamentally, I suppose, shouldn't matter so much. Good music is good music, but it did sort of make me think about how these things get used or how these things get informed by what's going on politically, which I think undeniably art tends to be informed by politics, and, you know, the extent to which that can end up being problematic.
Yeah, I mean, it's talking about versions of the past. I mean, in my day job, I met someone last week at Worcester University who was talking about the ways she's been very disappointed with the World War One commemorations. Mm. She had high hopes that ordinary people, social life, gender, etc. would all be taken into account, but in the end it has just been a sea of poppies and all about the Somme and all about the military.
Yeah.
And I think similarly, really, I mean, although I really like Ghostbox's output, and then another band I really like, Concretism, whose album we reviewed in April with Terry DeFellin and Des Mantle on the podcast. And I think all those artists have their heart in the right place.
Absolutely.
I think the criticism from the outside is that it is a bit white, it is a bit male, it's like a kind of version of the past, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're quite a geeky kind of version.
Yeah, and I guess it is a bit backward-looking to some extent. And, you know, I suppose the reinvented kind of futurism that they're sort of playing with, you know, you could argue it the other way, and I completely accept that. And I think there are much more willing culprits or than anyone who's involved with the Ghost Box label, you know, because they do put out some really great stuff and they do enjoy it. So I think, you know, probably if exploring this, particularly in this political context, it's worth kind of referencing Retromania, the Simon Reynolds book, which itself, I think, did touch on Ghost Box slightly, but also talked about, you know, that if you're talking about sort of retroism and nostalgia as a manifestation of that, or that as a manifestation of nostalgia, then there's, you know, there are entire kind of scenes which you know exist in the fringes, like rockabilly music scenes, you know, which have no intention of trying to update or gesture towards the future. They're resolutely backward facing. Also, I mean, you could say punk music scene to some extent, particularly in this country. I listened to quite an interesting podcast that I'd recommend called Punks in Pubs, which is a guy who basically interviews people in the punk music scene. And there was an interview with two of the members of the band Petrol Girls, who are a feminist punk band, who were talking about playing the Rebellion Fest, which happens in Blackpool, I think, every year. And they were sort of criticising the festival, and also more broadly some of the people who play at the festival and go to the festival, about sort of being punk and rebels and stuff like that. And yet they were kind of reliving a sort of, you know, reheated version of 1977, you know, Mohawks and leather jackets, and actually found it quite, when they spoke on stage about issues like feminism, real life political issues, that was kind of like not taken on board very well. Mm-hmm. And this is by a crowd that's supposed to be of the left, trying to smash the system. And you wonder about, you know, the extent to which nostalgia kind of ends up infiltrating that as a music scene. I suppose it comes down to the thing is, you know, is punk a sort of a form of music or a form of fashion, or is it like a philosophy and an art form, you know?
Yeah, the original punk was quite well versed in sort of feminism, you know, with the likes of Hurry Up and
But equally, you could say that the original punk, as it was like, you know, bands like the Sex Pistols were effectively just trying to ape, you know, like it was Malcolm McLaren trying to do like a kind of 50s pastiche to start
off with, wasn't it?
You know, yeah. So it's probably been linked in at the centre from the very start.
Mm. I mean, so on an industrial scale, we've seen this kind of commercially with big tours like Rewind, which is the big 1980s tour that tends to get the kind of B-listers together, your Nick Kershaws and your Howard Jones and those kind of people to sort of get in a field and in Hampshire or Berkshire or whatever, and then tons of people show up to those, and that's been recently superseded by Cool Britannia, which is a kind of, again, the B-listers but from a different musical genre, in this case like Britpop. So, you know, your Sleepers and your Echo Bellies and your Salads and those kind of people.
Well, your Terrorvisions, the frontman of which now runs a coffee shop in my hometown. And in fact, they were out on tour. They did a sort of cult tour called Britpop Must Die or something, or which was basically, like, I think the tour bill was Terrorvision, Reef and the Wild Hearts, and you just wonder what kind of like wormhole everyone slipped down. But that will get, from a commercial standpoint, that will generate a lot more ticket sales than three brand new up and coming bands, won't it?
You know,
so from a promoter's point of view, it's a no-brainer.
And the admittance price for some of these festivals is simply jaw-dropping, isn't it? I mean, you're talking between £75 and £100 most of the time for a day-long festival.
And then they're pitching to a crowd who are more kind of willing to put down that kind of money, and the younger crowd might not be, well, either have the capacity to do that or interest in doing that.
Yeah, I mean, so is this all only affordable? And I'm talking about other things as well, like sort of the vinyl revival, one could argue, sort of nostalgia tours, gigs by particularly huge names. Are they only really affordable to older people? You know, particularly with younger people finding it harder and harder to make ends meet with, like, university fees and all the rest, and coming up with huge debt, you know?
I mean, it's probably something you'd need to sort of do a survey on. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of kind of youngsters, I say, someone in their mid-30s, you know, who are kind of crate digging, and if their favourite band releases an album and they can get a sort of gatefold sleeve double vinyl indie record store special issue, then that's what they'll want to go and buy themselves. But what they're probably not doing is rebuying on vinyl all the albums that they bought on CD 20, 30 years ago, you know, and spending money twice on the same thing, I guess, in the way that some other people might be doing who are a bit longer in the tooth.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's incumbent in this regard that when newer bands are up for maybe the prices to be kept fairly low, so that does tempt people in. And I'd say in Oxford generally, actually, I'm quite impressed by the level of the prices to see new bands. I mean, nationally known bands are often only like about £10 or £11 to see. So, you know, and I think that's always quite
probably
a good deal.
Even less in Leeds and some venues.
But you want to take a chance on acts. I mean, that's how I got into music in the first place in the 90s. You know, you want to kind of, or in the 80s rather, you want to go along and or buy an album by a band where you've hardly heard anything, but just like you like the sound of them, or even just you like the name or the artwork on
or
the stage.
Or that you just, you know, you just like going to a particular venue and the price of admission isn't so prohibitive that it means that you can just go in, and if you end up seeing three bands that you think are pretty crap, it doesn't really make a lot of odds. Probably with pricing changes, that's going to be less of an option for some people, you know.
Yeah, some people would say, just play devil's advocate for a minute,
sure,
innovation, you know, music, you know, although there's new technology, etc., does it get harder with time, you know, to like do something properly new?
Yeah, good question. I mean, but possibly not, you know. There's certainly going to be people who will have a go at aping genres gone by or melding together two genres, possibly inadvisably, to try and make something new in a kind of Frankenstein's monster sense. I suppose at the end of the day, there's sort of what there's like sort of eight major notes in the scale, isn't there?
Yeah.
So there's always this sort of like, well, how kind of far can you take it, you know? And but there's, I suppose, by bringing together different elements and bringing together different viewpoints, whether that's politically, whether that's people who've had different cultural experiences from different cultural backgrounds, people of colour singing in the punk music scene, for example, which has predominantly often been like a white, you know, kind of scene, like the middle class scene as well. So, you know, these kind of, bringing these kind of new elements and viewpoints, standpoints, perspectives on different political issues to any form of, you know, music, I think that's probably more where the future lies than someone saying, I'm going to go out and invent a new instrument, you know, necessarily.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is, there's a myriad of new things that can be done. I mean, I would sort of mention now also there is maybe one of the phenomena that is bound up a little bit with ideas and nostalgia is so-called authenticity.
Sure. Yeah.
So it was very interesting at Ritual Union, which I mentioned earlier on Saturday, is that the vast majority of the bands are purist. Say if we had Simon Rattle show up to watch the bands, he would be a bit puzzled, I think, because there was a lot of music going on that was pre-programmed. You know, there was a lot of stuff coming out of boxes and machines, and, you know, synthesizers apart, you know, it was at times, you know, quite interesting trying to work out where the sound were coming from. The one exception to that was Nadine Shah, who had a very, very kind of prestigious kind of backing band, including Terry Edwards, who's worked with loads of people like Nick Cave and Tindersticks, etc., on saxophone. And it was very much, it was an analogue sound. Yeah, there were some synths, but it was very much an analogue sound for her.
Mm.
And that really stood out during the day, unlike Nod, who I mentioned earlier on, where it was pretty much all coming out of boxes.
Programmed,
even though on the record they do use drums and guitars. So this authenticity thing is that's often sort of chirruped as an important element as to why some music's better than others, and I think generally we wouldn't necessarily agree with that, but at the same time,
I think it probably plays into some of the worst elements of nostalgia when it comes to music, you know. It's sort of that sort of thing, like, oh well, anyone could do that, you know, it's just pressing buttons, you know, like, you know, they haven't spent 15 years learning their craft to play guitar really, really well, but every musician did that, we'd just end up with every band sounding like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, wouldn't we? You know, it's just really what everybody wants. You know, there might be some people who are bloody Joe Satriani or something like that. You know, so I think it's a bit of a non-argument, to be perfectly honest. You know, I suppose it comes into the back to the stuff around authenticity is also around people who maybe complain that music isn't in the current climate should be more political. I'd say that gets blown out the water to some extent, you know, because I think you could point to like the Najim Shah record, you know, which is quite kind of nakedly political and angry about the issues it's speaking about. But the sense of, well, there should be more of this stuff in the charts, well, it's only going to be in the charts if enough people download you know. So
and there's stuff, I mean, probably the most lo-fi, well, the most inauthentic band in terms of musical output that I know is Sleeve of Mods, and there are a few kind of more political bands.
Absolutely, definitely.
That's quite interesting. And of course, I think just to round off this discussion, a lot of people listening to this, including some of our regular participants on the pod, will be thinking, you're sitting there having a go at nostalgia when this podcast is absolutely steeped in it, and that's unapologetic. I mean, I'm not a young man, so, you know, that's always going to be the case.
It's possibly also worth sort of pulling back the curtain somewhat and saying that we're recording this podcast in Liverpool, which when it comes to sort of musical nostalgia in many ways is a bit of a capital of it, isn't it? You know, like, you know, because there'll be people, I mean, after this we can go down the cavern and, you know, relive the 60s, you know, the early 60s, can't we, for an evening if we want to, you know, so...
Yeah, which I think is really relevant, because I think this came up on the other big Northwestern City pod that we did on Manchester music, and how, one can argue this, but certainly in terms of bands who found fame, you know, Manchester sort of had a huge amount of success in the 70s, 80s and 90s, and then far less since.
Yeah.
And maybe that is because the city, and Liverpool would also be guilty of this, has maybe sort of started to look back on its own past a little bit too much, and to sort of glorify those kind of baggy and sort of you know, Merseybeat and various other kind of forms of music, and rather than thinking, oh, let's move on. And of course electronic acts and hip hop acts have come out of both cities, but maybe haven't perhaps had that full exposure that one might expect.
Yeah, and I think there's an indie nostalgia. We've touched on it, you know, with regard to these tours, and you get things like Rockaway Beach, which is one of the big Butlins and Mineheads kind of shows, where you're getting indie bands of the moment, but also kind of indie bands dragged out of retirement to play at these things as well. So I suppose there's some element of cross-pollination going on there, but there's possibly, it's a kind of very kind of curated, I guess, of, you know, space to people to immerse themselves in that, you know, just for a weekend or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fine line, isn't it? Because I'm going to see the House of Love at the Roundhouse in a couple of weeks, actually, and I think it's been billed as being a showcase for their first album, which is great, but at the same time, as someone I'd like to think who's open-minded about music, I would also have been quite interested to have heard some new stuff. So I guess it's a balance. I wouldn't want a whole gig of new stuff, and I think this is it. I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's just about sort of stuff coexisting. I don't think nostalgia has to be a bad thing. It's kind of inevitable, but, you know, I think we've always got to keep an eye out for what's new and what's different, or else things will just get stale. Okay, well, thanks for talking about that, Neil. After this break, we're going to be talking about our album of the month, which is going to blow the parental advisory lyrics credentials of this podcast completely out of the water. Well, earlier on we mentioned various podcasts, including sort of a punk one that Neil mentioned earlier on, and Damien Abraham of the band Fucked Up has got his own podcast, Turned Out a Punk, which I really recommend. It's really great, and if there was ever a podcast that did veer a little bit towards the nostalgia, that's certainly one, but in a good way, I think.
Definitely.
His band from Toronto have got a new album out, Dose Your Dreams, and Neil, what do you think?
So I'm going to go ahead and say it. Fucked Up, their new album just come out. It's quite hard to work out because they have had a lot of issues. I mean, I think Hidden World was the first proper album, wasn't it? Then Chemistry, Common Life did come. So I guess their fourth one now. Their first for Merge Records, I think.
Right.
The other ones were on Domino, I think. Or Matador, rather. But yeah, I mean, I think they've always been an ambitious band. You know, that's been it from the get-go. And they've got steadily more ambitious to the point where you kind of wonder. I think the last record they had, Glass Boys, was a little bit more straight ahead. It's 10 tracks, it was slightly shorter. This one, they've pushed the boat out pretty far, I think it's fair to say. Not just in terms of length of songs, guesting with other musicians, bringing another maybe instrumentation into the sound that was usually, you know, even though they were pulling it in different directions, generally kind of guitar, bass, drums, shouty vocals stuff. But they've also, this particular album, they've kind of gone in some pretty interesting, in my opinion, directions in terms of the kind of musical genres that they're playing with. If you told me at the start of the year that there'd be a new Fucked Up album come out and it would have like a strong baggy flavour to it, I probably wouldn't have believed you. But I think undeniably some of the songs, if you're looking for touch points, you know, there's one or two songs where the Happy Mondays are probably like closest, you know. Yeah. In some cases, there's definitely some more shoegaze moments, as some more like electronic aspects to the sound. I mean, I think for a band which, interestingly, I think has quite a, has different players bringing different things to the kind of songwriting process, I think it's quite interesting and inspiring and affirming to see them pushing themselves with each album and trying to take it in a new direction. And there are, I think because this is a quite a long record, it's 16 tracks, and I can't hand on heart say all of it works. I think there are definitely bits where, you know, some songs that fall down a little bit. But equally, I'd say it's probably got some of the strongest material that they've written, to my mind anyway. So I'd be really interested to get your take, Rob, on what's kind of your, what your impressions have been, particularly around the fact that they have, you know, chosen at times to sort of not just have Damien Abraham duet with other people, but in some cases not even have him sing and other people take the lead.
I think that's probably a good move, although I do have a lot of time for his voice. I think it is important to kind of leaven it. I think if you'd had 16 tracks over like an hour and 15 minutes, or however long it is, just of him, it becomes a bit relentless. And I think similarly to another band that go down the hardcore route, Deaf Heaven, who had an album out earlier in the summer, I mean, they also have like some guest vocalists on it, which work really well indeed. I think it's a bit long. Mm-hmm. I think we've mentioned this. I mean, it's possibly a bit bloated, but they've always gone for the operatic, the thematic, the cinematic. Yeah. I mean, David Comes to Life, which is probably my favourite album of theirs, that was like a kind of concept album about a kid living in a small town, in a small market town in Britain.
Yeah, and I think, and it's interesting with this album because I've sort of read marketing bump about the album that it's supposed to be a continuation of that story,
right?
And like, he might have, you know, like, and I was trying to sort of trace a thread of like, has he moved to Manchester and he's going to the Hacienda or something like that, you know, is that supposed to, and he's discovering drugs and you know, that's informing part of the sound. I did read an interview or something where, you know, Damien Abraham, who wrote the lyrics, said he found out what the concept of the album was when he read the marketing press release about the album. So that kind of sort of throws that into the shade somewhat. But I mean, I think there's, if there is a kind of common thread, you know, lyrically, there's a lot of stuff about kind of battling personal demons, you know, looking for the good in life, belief in yourself, you know, hasn't always been at the centre of a lot of punk music, which has been more kind of negative and about smashing the system. So I think that's, you know, I think sort of it's quite good to see that foregrounded. I love some of the, you know, I totally take your point of being too long. Some of the tracks, I think, that really stand out. I mean, there's a great one that's got Jay Maskus from Dinosaur Jr. guessing on lead vocals on it, which is just, I mean, it's just unmistakably him when his voice comes in, which is brilliant. But I think that's a really strong track. And I mean, throughout the record, there's, you know, there are sort of all sorts of different elements coming in, which, you know, it's just makes for an exciting listen because you are genuinely from track to track thinking, okay, well, where's this going to go next? And I think that sort of, coming back to nostalgia, you know, that sort of is something with a kind of long form album. That's kind of what you want from that, I think.
Well, he's so... If anybody listens to the podcast or has followed his career, Damien Abraham, the lead singer of Fucked Up Ladies, would realise just how extraordinarily musically literate he is. I mean, he kind of... What he doesn't know about music, and not just punk, about any music isn't really worth knowing. And in that, I think he reminds me a little bit of James Murphy of LCD Sound System. Right, completely different genre of music.
I'd say they're another touch point on one or two tracks as well, which again I wouldn't have expected.
I mean, those rare people. I mean, they once described the Horrors as purveyors of kind of record collection rock, and I guess that sort of possibly is taken to an even... If it's record collection rock, it's pretty bloody big record collection.
I mean, as a crate digger, I think he's probably got like all kinds of like weird, hard to get hardcore punk 7 inches that no one else has probably even heard, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting just to bring this back full circle to what we were talking at the top. I mean, we mentioned LCD as a kind of a touch point, and even Happy Mondays, and then there's obviously a lot of kind of punk influence. I'd say there's a Hold Steady or a bit of an influence in terms of the kind of the guitar interplay, but actually the album as a whole, not in terms of sound but just in terms of concept, was probably Queen, actually. in terms of the album construction, you know, of having this kind of, as you say, kind of operatic kind of construction to the way the album, you know, runs, and it has these different almost kind of like movements and peaks and troughs and things. They were the band that sort of came to mind more than anyone else when I was thinking about it. You might disagree with me virulently.
Well, there you go for the pod. We started with Queen tonight, we're ending with them, and I'm sure we might have a comment if any of the panel for episode 35 have seen the film when it comes out. I think we might have some feedback on that in November, which will be the next episode. Thanks very much for listening, everyone. Thanks, Neil. Great to have you back on the pod.
Yeah, cheers,
in our new Liverpool studio. Now, we've got several different studios in different cities now.
So, don't know how we're affording this.
Yeah, and follow us on @soundingboard69 on Twitter. And look forward to having you listen in to us again next time.
Listening. You can interact with the team at @soundingboard69 on Twitter and Facebook.